Le cuoce la lingua.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. Well, that'll change a guy's talk. I was telling Lee and my sponsor, Bob, before the meeting, I was up in my room and I was praying as we do before we do something like this. And I got a little emotional because Sandy was a huge part of my sobriety. It's a funny experience for me because all of the members of the panel at most of these events that I get to participate in are people that when I was 1 week and 1 month sober, I was given their tapes to listen to. They're people that I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous listening to, and Sandy was very much a part of my early sobriety before I ever met him, and I was honored, as many of you were, to meet him, and that this event is honoring Sandy is a beautiful thing, and I get to participate in a small way, and I get to share my experience on step 6 and 7 means a lot to me. I want you to lower your expectations for me from where Lee set them. If you would put your expectations where Bob Bazance's expectations are, we'll have a much better time the next hour together. We're going to talk about step 6 and 7. Obviously, we're going to talk a lot about God. And when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous, God was a very difficult subject for me. I grew up in a Jewish home. That's not really true. I grew up in an atheist Jewish home. Now, what that means is that we were Jewish, but we knew we were wrong. My mom would say things to me like, God and religion, they're the opiate of the masses. Now, get dressed for temple. We're leaving in 10 minutes. We would do all the festivals and we'd have all the stuff, and I was bar mitzvahed and I went to Jewish school. But I knew that it was a farce and it was just kind of this ritualistic thing that we did. But still, when I came here and you guys started to talk about God as you understood him, I knew who you meant. I mean, you can try and kid me. You can dress it up in God as he may express himself in our group conscience. But I got to tell you, if you're not from some form of a Christian faith, and it's the mid-1990s, and you're getting sober in Las Vegas, it feels like that's who they're talking about. And I just couldn't connect. I mean, first of all, my ancestors killed him. Okay. Now, I probably offended a few Jewish people in the room. I know that's not true. It's just a little joke. We're going to have several of those over the next hour. Try not to get too mad at me for it. But you still kind of feel like a stranger in a strange land, like you can't fit, like you can't belong. Imagine if you would for a minute, if you were getting sober in a country where perhaps the predominant religion was a Muslim faith, and you're a Christian or a non-Muslim and you're in the room and people are talking about God as he may express himself in the group conscience, you might get a sense of what it feels like for this little Jewish kid who's not really, I can't do my faith because I know it's nonsense, and I can't do your faith because, well, gosh, the only people on the planet that are more wrong than the Jews are the Christians, for crying out loud. I mean, these are the two things that I know about God, right? And so I don't know if I can, but I got great sponsorship. And my sponsor says, why don't you just get off the debating team? Just, you know, he told me things like, you're not supposed to find God in step 2. What do you mean? You're not supposed to find God. Came to believe in a power greater than me? It's where you come to believe. Said, no. So what about step 3? I can't do step 3 either. I'm going to make this decision to turn my will and my life over to this God that I should have come to believe in and I don't believe in. So I can't do that either. No. Don't worry about it. And he explains. what it says in the book in step two, where it says that we had to come to this realization, this question: do I now believe in God? Well, no, I don't believe in God. That's an easy question. Do I now believe in God? No. Are you even willing to believe that God might exist? Well, I don't know. I don't think, maybe. Am I willing to believe that perhaps, maybe, there might be, perhaps, probably not, I doubt it. It's ridiculous. Don't be silly. No. Maybe. Might be. Maybe a God. Maybe. There might be. Possibly. There might be a God. Maybe. I don't think. No. No. I mean, it's ridiculous to think about. But I'm willing that maybe, perhaps, possibly, there might be a God. Good. If you're working on step two, we just did it together. Let's move on, right? I mean, it's really that. I mean, the book even says that as soon as a guy can say that maybe, perhaps, possibly, probably not, I doubt it, but maybe, so, yes, then we emphatically, like with passion, emphatically, like assure him, he's on his way, you're done. So step three, say the prayer. I mean, how are you working on step three? Say the prayer. Say the prayer. And so I'm argumentative, so I want to know how you can prove to me that that nonsense is true, because it just sounds like nonsense. And he says, well, go ask people in AA that you love and trust and you like their life, and ask them, how is it that they're sober today? So I run off, I start asking guys, and they all say the same thing. It's almost like we hand out little cheater cards at meetings, right? How are you sober today? Well, I'm sober today because of a power greater than myself that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to stay sober one day at a time. I'd like to thank AA for God, and I'd like to thank God for AA. Right? And I don't mean to goof on that, because if you ask me why I'm sober today, I'm going to tell you that I'm sober today because of a power greater than myself that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that enables me to stay sober one day at a time, and I really honestly, without joking, would like to thank AA for God, and in turn, I'm pretty grateful to God for AA, and I don't mean to make light of that because it's true. So if that's the case, and if you find God, if God is what keeps you sober, and you could find God in step two or step three, why would you do step four? I mean, it sucks. Right? It does. Step five is embarrassing. Six and seven, I don't understand. Eight and nine are expensive. 10 and 11 are confusing. And 12 takes an awful lot of time, and quite frankly, I'm busy. Right? And unless it's having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, and we got to do all of them if we're going to have a spiritual experience. So, okay, I'll write my fourth step. I get it. I'll do step five. But step six and seven were very... I don't know how your experience was. My experience, I was very, very young in sobriety when I did my fourth and fifth step. In fact, I remember I had kind of this weird resentment because I was less than 30 days sober when I shared my fifth step. I went to Prescott to a conference with my sponsor. He was speaking at the conference. And I'm doing my fifth step, and then they did the countdown, and I had to stand up for less than 30 days. And I'm thinking, I was 28 days sober. Shouldn't I get, like, credit for 2 or 3 days for doing my fifth step, right? I mean, shouldn't I not have to stand up at less than 30? So I was very young in sobriety. So I'm faced with this six and seven question that, quite frankly, I don't understand. And I don't think I was supposed to understand it. It kind of breezed by me in a way of, you know, read six, and are you willing, and I guess, I don't even really understand what my, I know this. I know that I don't want to live the way I've been living anymore. I know that in step five, I swallowed some big chunks of truth about myself. I know that. And I know that what I swallowed about myself wasn't fun. I mean, I had written this inventory of all the people in my life that I was either mad at or afraid of or didn't like, or had some uncomfortability towards. I mean, and it wasn't a short list. I mean, really, it was, you know, my dad, and then my mom, right, and then my brother, and then any girl I'd been with, and then any boss I'd worked for, and then my cousins. I really just kind of trickled down to anyone I'd had any even minor influence in my life all the way to childhood. I mean, it was just this list of pathetic relationships, and everyone was like, it was funny that at 28 years old, I had lived a life that there was nobody that had had any real significant time spent with me that I wasn't in some way mad at, right? All of them. Even down to the lunch lady when I was 6 years old. I was mad at the lady that served me my tater tots. And I was really mad at her. Now, she deserved it, right? She deserved it. Talked to Larsine about that and Butch, and they agree she deserved it. But it's still pathetic, right? That I had to. I've lived this life where there is, you talk about no friendly direction. Not no friendly direction necessarily because of the things I do when I'm drinking. Although I have lots of people that are mad at me because I'm not a very good drinker. I'm not the guy that shoots pool better when he's drunk. I'm not the guy that dances better or plays guitar better. I'm the hit on your mom, pee on your couch kind of drunk. I mean, I love that line in the book where Bill says that we are often dangerously or disgustingly antisocial. I am not very dangerous, but I'm disgusting, you know? And so I got some stuff, right, where I've made people mad when drinking, but there are people on this list that had minimal contact with me when I was drinking, and I'm mad at them, or they're mad at me, and there's definitely one thing is for certain, that there is separation between me and everybody in my life, and I don't want to live that way anymore. And am I willing, step six says, to let God have these character defects? Yeah, I'm willing to let. Sitting post step five, you know, sitting for an hour, or a week or a month, or however long I brooded on this stuff about what my life had been like, I didn't want to live that way anymore. I didn't want to be that way anymore. And I say the seventh step prayer. And I go about the business of living my life, and I go about the business of making amends, and I start trying to get involved a little bit in 10 and 11, which, you know, in my story, I really didn't have any kind of a regular practice in those steps till 10 years of sobriety. And to call it regular now might be an exaggeration. I get real good, and then I realize it's been a while since I did it, and I get real good again, and I realize it. But I get about my life of trying to live my life, this sober life. But it's a funny deal, man. I don't know what happened. I go to work, and it seems like everybody at work knows how to work better than I know how to work. They seem to get along with each other, and I don't seem to get along with people the way they seem to get along with people. Things happen, and I get frustrated at things that they don't seem to get frustrated at. I get upset about things that when I talk to my coworkers, I'll say to them, "Can you believe that they're doing this?" And they go, "Yeah, no big deal." And I, "What do you mean, no big deal? Come back here. Let me explain to you exactly how big of a deal this is." Things that happen with friends and in romantic situations and all throughout my life, it just seems like, and I'm talking to God, and I'm asking, and I don't want to be this guy that gets uptight, but I'm this guy that gets uptight. I'm the guy that seems to make amends for the same thing over and over again. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but I worked at a job for 14 years with a boss he was a difficult guy. And one of the things that's troublesome for me when there are difficult people, if you can find somebody to agree with you that person is a difficult person, now you're right about your judgment of them, and it's way more dangerous. And this guy was a difficult guy, and I would overreact to the things that he would say and do. And I would get uptight, and I would get full of angst, and I would just get on the muscle, and I would get crazy, and I'd go to my sponsor, and I'd talk to my sponsor about this guy. And it would be like we would do 4 and 5 on this guy continuously. And he'd do that AA voodoo that they do, right? He'd do that, "This was our call" stuff. "Well, you know, Sheldon, maybe the guy had a bad day. You don't know what happened with his wife before he left for work, or you don't know the stress that he has that's coming from his boss, or, you know, maybe he's, with his experience, he sees you doing things that he would do differently. And if you were in his shoes, and you had his fear, and you had his discomfort, and you had his angst, and you had his motivators, and you had the things driving him, that could you see how you may have behaved that way? And yes, I can see how he may have behaved that way. And so then I would run off, and I would have to make amends to the guy, because I'm not real good at restraining the pen and tongue. Right? So I go back to that. Hey, you know, yesterday when I said that thing that I said, I'm sorry that I said that. And it got to a point where, honestly, I would go to his office and I would knock on his door. I'd say, hey, boss, you got a minute? And he'd smile. Because he knew. Oh, this must be one of those amends that you're going to make. Yeah. And my sponsor's big on doing nice stuff for people, you know, so find out how he takes his coffee, and I'd be stood at his door with a Starbucks cup, and he'd be like, oh, this'll be fun. But I could do the inventory, and I could make the amends, but I would continue the behavior that I was promising that I wouldn't do anymore. And I didn't seem to be able to stop that behavior. It seemed like at some point in early sobriety it was a little bit less troublesome for me, because in early sobriety I didn't even see the behavior happening. In early sobriety what would happen is that I would get this angst about life. Life would not seem to treat me fair. It would always seem like they were out to get me, they were not on my side, if they could only understand. I love that stuff in 60 through 63, the actor that Bob talked about. If only my the people would stay put, if only they do what I thought they should do, then we'd be fine. And the problem really is that they don't seem to want to do things my way. The way I live my life is that I agree that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my troubles. Your selfishness and your self-centeredness, right? And if only you would start behaving correctly, then we'd be fine. And so in early sobriety, what's happening is that I'm doing this inventory over and over again on the same things in my life, whether it's people in the home group or the guy at the meeting that always seems to share at me, or my at the time my fiance or new wife or my mom, and it's just all these people. And what's awful is that I'm living this life in angst, but I'm not really suffering as much from it in early sobriety as I started to after some time in AA, because I was blind to what was going on. So what happens is that I get this angst, I get this uncomfortability, I get this heartache, I get this pain, I go to my sponsor and I think it's their fault, and we inventory it. And then he points out to me where I behaved wrong. One of the most painful things that I've ever had to do in AA, and I don't know if you might enjoy this, but it's putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. It's like, you almost need a surgical procedure to have that done, right? Because, boy, that's like locked into my fiber, for God's sakes, right? But we get through that, and then I go make the amends again, and I go try to go about my life, and my life doesn't seem to make sense. It almost feels like I'm getting sicker. And I try to talk to this about people that are in my life. I remember having a conversation with my dad about this. And my dad's not in AA. And so I tell my dad, you know, we have this intimate conversation. I tell him, geez, you know, I just feel like in some areas of my life I'm really failing. I'm failing you and I'm failing other people in my life. And he looks at me like I'm crazy. Because outwardly, the action in Alcoholics Anonymous is allowing me to act better in most situations. My actions have improved. But what's happening is that thing that we talk about in AA, where we talk about the road getting narrower, what Bob talked about, we awaken. I'm starting to awaken to my actions and to the way that I live in the world. And I feel like I'm getting sicker. I remember one night, you know, they always say in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they joke about if you have a good idea, you should call your sponsor. If you have a great idea, you should go see him, right? I think that could also be applied to your emotional state. You know, if you're having a tough day and you're really bound up tight, you should call your sponsor. But if you're really falling apart, you should go see him. And this particular night, I did that. I remember driving over to my sponsor. I called him. I said, I got to come see you. And I'm driving up to his house. And you got to kind of picture the change that has happened in my life to this point. Earlier on that day, now I got sober. I had been... homeless for a short while. I don't homeless well. It's not, Jews aren't good at that. We did our 40 years in the desert, and then we got places to live, and it's kind of against the faith now. And I say, anyway, I got to apologize again. But I spend most of my life apologizing. But anyway, I go to a detox, and I go to a halfway house, and then I end up moving to Vegas, and I get an apartment, and I got this apartment, and I can't keep the apartment, and I end up renting a room from some guy in the wrong part of town, a good AA member, and there's three of us living in this house, and I was living at the grace of other people. And then now you fast forward a couple 3 years, because I'm disgustingly antisocial, I'd been single for most of my life. I mean, I'm not attractive when I'm hitting on your mom and peeing on your couch. So it's a turnoff, you know, for most girls. So you know, I'd been single for a long time, and so now at this point in my life, I got a job. I got a couple of promotions. I bought a home. I got married. To an amazing member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had our son. We sold that house and bought another house. I'm a welfare kid from the wrong side of the tracks, and you have to picture that I'm sitting in my backyard in the hot tub, and I'm staring at the palm trees from my hot tub. And my wife's inside, and she's making dinner, and my son's playing in the playroom, and I'm thinking, is this all there is? The funny thing about that is that I believe that I honestly thought that if I could get a few bucks, a nice house, a good wife, and a kid, that those things would be a cure for alcoholism. Turns out that those are not a cure for alcoholism, and that people with far more material success than I have drink and kill themselves every day because of our disease. But I thought those things were a cure for alcoholism. But that day, I keep getting a little crazier. I end up going over to my sponsor's house, and I knock on the door, and he opens the door. And he says the funniest thing. It wasn't funny at the time. It's funny how most of what my sponsor said to me is funny in hindsight, but at the time sounds callous, right? But he opens the door and he goes, I know that look. That's the Sheldon can't manage his own life look. Right? These are the people I go to for help. He ushers me in, and we talk about what's going on with me and how I just feel, the bottom line is I feel like I'm in a world that's not on my side. I feel like, yeah, I'm sober now, and yeah, I'm sorry for all the crap that I did, and I'm sorry for the crap that I did while I've been sober this time, and I'm sorry for the crap that I'm going to do later, but I don't seem to be able to stop doing the crap, reacting that way. I just feel like it's not working. Like, I just don't, I can't, I was on the phone with a guy sponsor earlier on today, and he said to me something that I remember that feeling, sober, with his life in better shape than it was when we found him several months ago. I just don't think I can keep living like this. And I felt like I couldn't keep living like that. And I don't know what that is. I tried to explain to him what that was he couldn't keep living like. But he thought it was all the people around him and the circumstances and the situations he was in. And I felt like I couldn't keep living like this. But I knew I was starting to wake up to the idea that it was something in me, that I was the problem, that I don't know why I can't fit. I I get it. I saw the things I had to see in step five. It didn't stop me doing it again yesterday. And it hasn't stopped me from planning to do it tomorrow. Right? I mean, it's just... And we talked and he said to me something that made me nuts. He said, you're having a step six problem. I said, don't be ridiculous. At that time, I was 3, 4, 5 years sober. I was sponsoring a half a dozen guys. I was making amends. I'd done a fourth and fifth step. I've moved beyond step six. I'm on step 12. He thought it was funny. And he said something to me that has always stuck with me since. He said that the story of his serenity, the story of the peace that he has in his life, is directly equal to how willing he is in step six. And at the time, that didn't really make sense to me. I thought that step six was this step where I said, okay, these are the things that are objectionable to me. And then I said, I'm willing to have God take them. And then I said the prayer in step seven, and he took them. But that's not been the experience of my life. The experience of my life has been this journey of what it looks like for a guy like me to be willing to have God take these things. I don't give away these things freely. First of all, I think that they have value for me. I think that there is value for me in looking at your every move and making sure that you're doing what's best for me. I mean, if I'm not looking out for my best interest, who's going to? If I'm not worried about my money, who's going to? It's either me or the people that are trying to get my money, so I better worry about my money, and I better put a lot of energy into worrying about my money. If I'm not thinking about my sex life, who's going to? Right? I mean, I want to get a little when I can. Right? And so I need to be paying attention to that kind of stuff. If I'm not going to worry about my reputation, and I have to worry about my reputation, if I'm not concerned at all times about who's saying what and when they're saying it, and if they have the information accurate when they're saying it, I have to be my own press secretary. We were laughing on the way to the. To the meeting, and somebody said, Butch said, well, we'll have your people call my people. And I have a lot of people. They all live up here, right? And they're my people. And they're trying to manage everything. They're judging and managing and correcting and making sure that in every situation everything is being done correctly so I can be okay. And what happens is I go about my life looking at the world through this paradigm of how is the world affecting me. I go through the world through this paradigm of and it's when you say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous. I go through this paradigm of trying to change the world to fit me. Little me trying to change the giant world to fit me. And it's almost like, and I've heard many guys say this, Bob says this, it's almost like I have this magnetic force inside of me that is this powerful magnet. And all of the things that happen in my life have a magnetic quality. And so I go about my day at work and the boss looks at me. And I don't even, for all I know, he might have indigestion, right? But I read his look as sheer harsh judgment of what I'm wearing, what I look like, what I'm doing, what he pays me, you know, the vacation I requested, and boom, it sticks to me. And I go about my day, and then a customer looks at me funny or says something. It sticks to me. My wife asks about something that she wants to accomplish. And I take it as an assault. I take it as an attack. And it sticks to me. And my son rebels against something. And it sticks to me. And I end up walking around with this hunks of metallic crap. Right, weighing me down, making me uncomfortable, making me feel heavy, making my spirit feel weighed down, making me feel like the world is against me. And what's worse is that I'm a talented blacksmith. And so once these metal things have attached to me, then I get out my tools. And I now start to take these hunks of steel and forge them into a coat of armor that will protect me from you, that will keep me safe from the next assault. So when the next thing hits me, it bounces off my titanium armor that I have built between me and the world. And when I get sober, I don't know this, because I haven't learned the lingo of Alcoholics Anonymous yet, but if I could have told you how I felt when I got sober, it would have been more than anything lonely and separate. But when you look at how I lived my life building this iron, like I'm like, you know, the Black Knight of days of old, right? With every memory of everything that fancied or real. You know what's funny is that, I'm telling you, the reason fancied comes first is because most of them are made up, right? I mean, if it was like most of it's real and occasionally you got it wrong, it would be real or fancied. But oh no, Bill knew what he was saying. I mean, most of the stuff that I have used to separate me from you and protect me from the world is stuff that's not even real. But I got good at building armor. And if only there was some, you know, we talked about alchemy earlier on. If the alchemists, instead of trying to turn lead into gold, if they could have come up with a potion that I could have drank that would have turned off that magnet, I could have got by with my life. Oh, they did. They called it Chivas Regal on the rocks with a splash of water. Scare it to death, but don't drown it, right? Because I used to be able to drink and it would seem like it would turn off the magnet and my spirit would become alive. But in abstinence, you know, I do a fourth and fifth step, and I chip off some of the steel. I chip off some of the armor. I unbolt one of the plates that I have built. And in step 9, maybe I come out to you and I say, hey, I think this is your steel. I'm really so sorry. I'm so sorry. Let me fix what I did. But when I go through my life and I continue to live my life, poof, a new piece hits me. Poof, a new piece joins me. In step 3, they said this when I was, you don't hear this much anymore, and it's a shame because it's cute. When I was newly getting sober, if you said to a guy, I can't do step 3 because I don't really believe in God, and if I did believe in God, I don't know how to turn my will and my life over to the care of anything. And they go, ah, you don't have to do that, punky. Don't worry about it. It's only a decision. And then they'd say, if there's 3 frogs, right? You know this one, right? On a log. And one of the frogs decided to jump off. How many frogs are on the log? And I say 2, right? And they go, no, 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 punky. No, no, no. There's still 3 frogs on that log because it was only a decision. Well, what is this decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? What is it that I'm deciding to do? In essence, I suppose I'm deciding to make my life none of my business. In essence, what I'm saying is it pops from this point forwards to do with me right now, at this moment, whatever happens to me right now, to do with me, I give to you. And to build with me, that's my future. So for the future of my life, not just now, but in the future, Pops, I'm going to give that to you. I want you to take care of everything in my life. I'm going to stop making decisions. You know, my sponsor, he's got a lot of these mean, you guys think he's nice and clever from the podium, but he's got a lot of these mean things he says to you, right? And he says to me one time, this is classic. He says, I can teach you, Sheldon. The only reason you're mad is because you're not getting your way. Okay. Well, I can teach you never to get mad ever again. I can make it to where from this point forward, it's never ever again will you ever get unhappy because you don't get your way. How? Don't have a way. These are the people I go to for help, right? This is... But that's what I'm saying, isn't it? In step 3, I'm saying from now on, I'm not going to have a way. So 3 frogs on a log. One of those frogs takes step six. Splash. Two frogs left on the log. Because what I'm saying in step six is, okay, Pops, I get it. I did my third step. I did my fourth step. I looked at this stuff that's objectionable. I know that I react badly to life. I know I judge people harshly. I know I'm oversensitive. I know that the way that I look at the world is through this paradigm of how's it affecting me. I get it. I've seen the damage that's been caused. And I don't want to live that way anymore. And I'm going to make a decision from this point forwards not to live that way anymore. But I can't. But I can't. And so I go back and I do more inventory. And I can't. And what happens is I get glimpses of the answer to the question that I suppose was stopping me from taking step three in the first place. And I wouldn't want to verbalize this question in an open discussion meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because you get shared at, right? I'd get shared at for the rest of the meeting. But the question of step three that I want to say when you tell me to turn my will and my life over the care of God is this: what does a guy like me need God for? I mean, really? I mean, I don't mean that in a, you know, in a spiritual way. And I'm a spiritual neophyte. I mean, I know that God exists, and I know that He loves me, and I've had glimpses of really feeling that love. But what does a guy like me really need God for in a practical, pragmatic way? Not in a I want to go to heaven way, not in a, you know, in a look at the sunset way, but practically and pragmatically in my life. Monday morning, 9 a.m., what does a guy like me need God for? What a guy like me needs God for is that I can't stop reacting to life the way that I react to life. I can't turn the magnet off. I'm not capable of not having the judgment. I'm not capable of not looking at the world through the paradigm of how's this affecting me. I'm not capable of listening to the things that you say in between your sentences about how much you don't like me, don't love me, I'm not good enough, you can't trust me, I don't amount to anything. I'm not capable of not saying to you in verbal and nonverbal cues the mean things that my defense mechanisms make me say to you. This is what a guy like me needs God for. And the only way that the God that I understand can teach me that is if He makes that a struggle. Because the way that my mind works, and maybe your mind doesn't work this way, but the way that I experience the world is that if I were able to say, God, remove from me my judgment, and my judgment were to disappear, secretly I would think I did a great thing. I don't judge people anymore. Aren't I wonderful? Come with me, we'll judge the judges together. Right? Look at those people over there judging. They're not even as good at it as we were back in the day when we used to judge. Oh boy, so I need the struggle. I need the struggle for me to, and I don't like the struggle. I don't like, you know, the in my confusion of spiritual journey, I read some Eastern philosophy. And one of the things in Eastern philosophy that is a beautiful thing that they say, but I don't think they mean it. And I'll tell you what I mean when I say that in a minute, right? And this is as Sheldon sees it, right? But now the Buddhists are like, okay, you picked on the Jews, now you picked on the Buddhists. You're not fair. But they say that there is no pain in change, there is only pain in resistance to change. Which is true. I absolutely agree with that. But it sounds to a guy like me that's not very spiritually advanced that means I'm choosing to resist change. Right? Try to choose not resisting change, I dare you. Right? It's impossible. It's impossible not to resist the change. It is in the resistance to change that the struggle occurs that makes me realize that the change is good and that I need to stop resisting the change. But it is in the resistance to the change that I get to learn the growth. They call them growing pains. They don't call them growing tickles, right? Because this stuff kind of is uncomfortable for me. If I woke up tomorrow morning and there was no more struggle, and I was able to live my life in the pure manner that I think, it's funny, right? We don't claim, no one among us are saints. We all have feet of clay. And I'll tell you some stories in a minute about my current life that show that I'm still in this struggle. And we claim progress, not perfection. But if we're going to grow towards something, we have to have an idea of what that would look like, right? One of the things that some of my Christian friends used to do, and I thought it was great, you know, it was an easy thing to goof on, but the reality is a beautiful thing, is they were popular for a while, they wore those bracelets, what would Jesus do, right? What a great question. What would whatever God that you believe in, whatever pure spirit that you connect to, whatever your idea of this power in the universe is, how would that power have you behave? A good friend of mine in Vegas says that God is love. How would love look at this? So I know what the goal is. I know what the goal is. And if I were to wake up tomorrow morning and I were able to live up to the goal, and I was so good that I didn't need God anymore, the problem would be that I wouldn't need God anymore. And I don't think that I'm wired in a way that once I didn't need God anymore, I'd still turn to Him. I mean, I only know that because in my experience, before I got sober, when I didn't think I needed God, I didn't turn to Him. In early sobriety, when I thought that it was enough that I wasn't drinking anymore and that I was just grateful because I was able to pay the rent and my dad was talking to me again and the gifts of the first 6, 8 months, 2, 3, 4 years of sobriety were enough for me and I didn't think I needed God to help me with these things that I struggle with today, I didn't turn to Him. So what makes me think if I woke up tomorrow pure that I would still turn to Him? It is in the resistance to change and the struggle that I live in that keeps me to, when do I pray? I mean, not when do I pray the, I love what Bob said, when do I throw a paragraph at God, right? And on good spiritual hair days, when I feel plugged in, when my spirituality is tidal, it comes and goes, and when the tide is in, and I can have these beautiful moments with God, right? I have some beautiful moments with God. But when the tide's out and I feel alone and afraid, when do I go to God? It is in the moments of pain that I go to God. The struggle is the gift. Huh? That don't even make sense to me, and I said it, right? I mean, but it is. It is the struggle. It is the realization of my humanness that comes in step 6, my inability to live my life the way that I would hope that I could live my life, that is the gift that drives me back to God. So, I'm from Las Vegas. And I worked in the car business for a number of years, 14, 15 years. And I was quite successful. I did pretty well. And I got to a point where, because of a number of reasons, one of which was that I wanted time to seek God more. My schedule was jam-packed. I wanted more time in AA. I wanted more time to be able to come and do events like this. I wanted more time to be able to spend at detox with guys I sponsor. I wanted more time at home in my home group. And I wanted more time with my family. I have a beautiful wife. I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous. We married for 16 years. She's my best friend. And I honestly met her when I was 4 days sober. We started dating when I was 6 months sober. We got married when I was about a year sober. I've never drawn a sober breath, really, without her in my life. She is my partner in life. And I love her with all my heart. Would you make sure she gets a copy of this? Thank you. Thank you, Lee. I have a 13-year-old son that is the center of my world, and I wanted to spend more time with him. So, in August, I retire is a funny word. I'm too young and too driven, but I got out of the car business without knowing what the next journey of my life was going to be. and I stayed home. And my plan was for 6 months or a year, I'd kind of hang out, take some time with the family, and then figure out what the next step would be. And I'm very grateful that my life is set up in a way where I was able to do that. But 90 days into the journey, I'm a car salesman, and I'm not an educated car salesman. I never went to college. 90 days into the journey, I get a phone call from Drexel University, because a friend of a friend, well, I have a friend of my wife, and a friend of mine works there, and they needed some help in their business development center. And this girl said, "Can I show them your resume?" Which I thought was funny, because I'm not qualified at all. I said, "Sure, show them my resume." And then 2 weeks later, I get hired by Drexel University in Philadelphia to be their business development consultant to help rebuild their department, which is a big deal. And I'm not qualified for it. And it came out of nowhere. And it's very clear that God wants me in Philadelphia. I mean, it just felt, you never get that feeling where it just felt like God wants me in Philadelphia because this is insane. I mean, they interviewed me. They know what I'm capable of. They know my history. I went to college once. She was cute, you know, and I was, but I didn't stay. I mean, you know, I mean, I never, so I get this job, and it's, the funny thing is that all of the things that I wanted, more time in my home group, more time with my family, all those things evaporated. Because I leave Vegas on Sunday night, and I come home on Thursday night. When I come into a weekend like this, I just don't go home. I left Philadelphia and came here to be with you guys this weekend, and after the weekend, I'll go back to Philadelphia. So that was something that evaporated in this deal, but it made sense that I should go there, and it felt so like the right thing to do. And I called my sponsor, and I'm talking to Bob, and I'm in Philadelphia, and I'm sitting in this hotel, and I'm amazed at the power and beauty of the spirit of the universe that would take someone like me, an uneducated guy, and have him work amongst PhDs and guys with master's degrees and all this stuff. It paid me pretty well. It just seemed ridiculous. And he says to me, "Well, you know, Sheldon, within the next 3 or 4 months, you're going to call me and tell me that they don't respect you. And they're not treating you right. And just remember this conversation, because that one's coming." I just finished my 4th week with them. And last week, I wish I had stories that were, now 5 years ago I behaved this way, but I'm over that now because I'm wonderfully sober for 5 more years, and I'm, last week, they wanted to go over my expense report, which, all of which is done with honor and care and is accurate, and they didn't like some of the expenses. To the tune of tens of dollars. Tens of dollars. And I was mad. I was so mad. But here's what has happened in my experience with how this occurs. And this is, I think, the difference that I experience now as step 6 takes more of a hold in my life. Is that as I start to get mad, I have an equal driving emotion that is telling me, you're doing it again. You're about to do it again. You're wrong. Don't do this. But it was tens of dollars. So I can't help myself but get mad. But I'm mad at myself because I'm getting mad when I shouldn't be getting mad, and I know better. Why the heck am I getting mad? I shouldn't be getting mad. This is ridiculous. Sheldon, don't do this. Do not let this happen. I can't stop myself from making it happen. And I start to think to myself, you know, I should probably pray, but you know what? I'm in a meeting with the CFO and the assistant vice president, and I can't really say to them, hold on a minute. I mean, I probably could have taken a bathroom break and shoved the bath mat under the door so no one could peek under the bottom and said a prayer, and I probably could have done that, you know, but I wasn't really, so I'm sitting in this room and I can feel the pressure building. And the old me would have said, you know what, guys? If you don't respect me and you don't trust me, you don't want me to work for you, it's no big deal. I was sitting in my backyard when you called me. I'll go back to my backyard. I mean, after all, you know what? You're stealing me from all the things in my life that I love, and I don't really want to be here anyway. So why don't you guys have a good day? Because nobody talks to me in this tone about tens of dollars. I didn't say anything. I just shut down. There were some things that I probably, if it was a smart business situation, there were some things that I could have articulated to them, if I could have done it in a calm and kind, frank manner, that should possibly have been articulated. But I don't have it. I got either shut down or let me tell you the way it's going to be, boys. And I don't have the middle, and I know I don't have the middle, so I shut down. And I can't imagine what my physical appearance must have been to them. But it felt like I was doing this. And a little bit of this. But I think I was doing this. I hope I was. And I go home. And I'm mad. And I'm not so much mad at them as I am mad at me because I'm mad. I can't stop being mad. I can't stop it. I don't have it in me to stop the anger. And the anger's wrong, and I can see it. I am awake, and this is the thing that makes me crazy at this point in my sobriety. I'm hoping... That there's a point, you know, Bob was talking about when he's 35, 36 years sober, maybe at 45 years sober, he'll look back and realize he's a putz at 36 years sober. I don't think so, but maybe you will, right? But I'm hoping that there's a time that comes where when the anger rises, I can stop the anger. But I couldn't stop the anger. And I was trying. I'm so mad at myself because I'm so frustrated. And then I realize, you don't have what it takes to stop the anger. I love that part when in the fear inventory where itself says that many of us trusted self-reliance, but self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. You know, the truth of the matter is that I am not enough. I'm just not enough. It's not my fault I'm not enough. I can't go get more Sheldon. I'm not enough. Besides, more Sheldon would kill me. It's just more of the problem, for crying out loud, right? I mean, if self is the problem, self can't be the answer. I am not enough. I don't have it. What's missing? Where do I get it from? I got to go to God for it. How do I remember to go to God? The struggle. It's the struggle that drives me back to God. It's the struggle that keeps me plugged in. It's the things about me that I find objectionable that drive me back to the Father. So I ask God, God, what do I do? I can't take this. I can't go. If I go back to work tomorrow with this anger, I won't be able to control it. It's a matter of time. It's a ticking time bomb. I know what's going to happen. I'm going to go there tomorrow, and they'll have forgotten about this episode because they think it's behind them. We had our conversation, came to our agreement. They adjusted the deal a little bit, took some, didn't take others. To them, it's in the bag because, well, they're not like us, right? To me, it's wah, 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 wah. And so what's going to happen is a week from now, one of them's going to bring, they're going to come into a meeting with a cup of coffee for themselves, and I'm going to go, I knew it. They don't like me enough to bring me a coffee. It's the beginning of the end. I should just leave now. That's it. I'm leaving and it's your fault. I know you hate me and I hate you too. I know the future. So I asked God, God, how do I get beyond this? And I get the sense of what to do next. And it was the funniest thing. Make amends for your behavior. What? My behavior was fine. Maybe. Maybe. So I call the woman up who's driving this whole thing, and she's the woman that's been my wife's friend for many years. I wasn't able to reach her. I got her voicemail, and of course I immediately think she must have hit ignore because she hates me now, right? Turns out she was at the gym. Well, that's what she says. We can't be sure, can we? Spin cycle my hiney. But I tell her, I just left her a message and said, you know what, I want you to know that I was a little inappropriate in that meeting, and if I embarrassed you or affected you badly, I'm sorry. I hung up the phone. She had not heard the message yet. And that, I think, is important here. She had not heard the message yet. And the anger goes away. And the anger goes away. And God comes in the space and fills the space. Stop resisting me, Sheldon. Stop having a way. Go with the flow. Stop it, Sheldon. I got you. I got you. And you can't get you, so stop getting you. Because all you're going to get you is in trouble. Stop it. And I wish I didn't. Part of me wants to say, I wish I didn't have to have the struggle. But part of me says, you know what the truth is? Is that if I'd have been sitting in that office and they'd have said that, and I would have said, well, it's no big deal. Okay, if that's the way it's going to be, that's fine. I wouldn't have connected with God that night in that apartment the way that I did. I would have, and what's more important in my life? The fact that I can tell you that I reconnected with God over a situation that was difficult and troublesome and that I was struggling with, and the result of it was that I had a moment of reconnection with God, or that I didn't behave badly and embarrass myself a little bit in the first place. In the outside world, outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the regular world, they would say that it would be best if you just didn't embarrass yourself. But this isn't the real world. This isn't the regular world. This is the spiritual journey where the nuggets and the beauty and the apples are the things that drive me and reconnect me to God. And so as much as I hate the struggle, I love the struggle. As much as I hate the resistance to change, I'm glad that I can't just change. Because a guy like me needs to be driven back to God. There is no room inside of me for my ego and for God. You know, in early sobriety, they told me that ego stood for edging God out, and it's cutesy, but it's real. God's a gentleman, right? He only goes where he's invited, and the ego doesn't invite God ever. So it's only through the collapse of the ego, through the struggle and the strain and the inability to accomplish the things and to behave in the ways that I wish I could behave, it is in the failure to hit the perfection, the WWJD, it is in the inability to hit the target that I think I would like to hit. It is in there that the ego collapses and allows God to come in. It is in there that I feel connected. And so stood here today, on the other side of that incident at work, I am grateful for the way that that incident happened, because I got to learn things I would not have otherwise learned, seen things I otherwise wouldn't have seen. Things that are not new, not new lessons. Lessons I need to learn over and over again. Not new things, not new visions. Visions I need to see over and over again. There's a very short two-line poem that I want to share with you. I think one of the things that is key for me in this step is that in step six, what I really get is a full knowledge of the fact that I don't have power. I think the lesson of step six is the lesson that there is one that has all power. That one is God, may you find him now, and that I don't have power. And it is my powerlessness in step three that I begin to talk about, that the frog goes splash in step six and starts to really learn about. In step six, I really learn about my powerlessness. And in step seven, I come to God and I say the prayer, humbly. Where else do I get humbly from, if not from all this activity in step six, the stuff that I've been talking about for almost an hour? This is where I get humbly from. And in step seven, where I say to God, remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way. God, have all of me, the good and the bad. Because I don't know what's good and I don't know what's bad. I mean, you know, truth is what I think is good for me is hookers and crack, right? That's where I started the journey, right? So who am I to judge what's good and what's bad? God, take it all. Take it all from me. Take it all from me. I'm starting to see my powerlessness. Take it all from me. Remove from me the defects of character which stand in the way of my usefulness to you and your fellows. The poet Rumi says, your task is not to seek for love. I suppose we could say your task is not to seek for God. Your task is not to seek for love, but to merely seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. And step six is the place that I start to find the barriers. And step seven is where I humbly turn those over to God. Thank you for my life.